From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
There are five steps in our plan to help Iraq achieve democracy and freedom. We will hand over authority to a sovereign Iraqi government, help establish security, continue rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure, encourage more international support, and move toward a national election that will bring forward new leaders empowered by the Iraqi people.
As President Bush delivers a major primetime address on Iraq, we'll hear from an Iraqi poet exiled under Saddam Hussein who's made a new film about his return to Iraq after the invasion called About Baghdad.
Well, once again, Bush is obviously detached from the reality that Americans face here in Iraq, but also from the reality that Iraqis live with every day in post-Saddam Iraq, which we try to depict in our film About Baghdad.
And another new film, Control Room, about Al Jazeera's coverage of the invasion of Iraq.
Al Jazeera has a pattern of playing propaganda over and over and over again. What they do is when there's a bomb goes down, they grab some children and some women and pretend that the bomb hit the women and the children.
It's really sometimes hard to understand the critics directed by the U.S. government against Al Jazeera. But if sometimes, I tell myself, if sometimes being objective consists in being anti-American, why not? But believe me, we've never been anti-American.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a primetime address Monday night, President Bush vowed to send more troops to Iraq if requested by the military. He said, quote, "If they need more troops, I'll send them." 138,000 U.S. soldiers are currently stationed in Iraq. Nearly 800 have died since the U.S. invasion began last March. In his 31-minute speech, President Bush also vowed sovereignty would still be handed over to Iraq on June 30th. But questions still linger as to how much sovereignty Iraq will actually have. On Monday, the U.S. put forth a new U.N. resolution that clearly states the new Iraqi government will not have the power to ask occupying troops to leave the country or to overrule military missions carried out by the U.S. and its partners. For Bush, the speech came on the day that his approval rating dropped to a new low, 41%, according to a new CBS poll. The president is planning to give five more primetime speeches on Iraq in the coming weeks in what the Washington Post describes as a tightly orchestrated public relations effort. How the speech played out in Iraq is less clear since Bush began speaking at around 4 in the morning, Baghdad time. During his speech, Bush announced the U.S. would tear down the Abu Ghraib prison if the new Iraqi government wants that to be done. Abu Ghraib has been a symbol of abuse and torture both under Saddam Hussein and the U.S. troops. In other Abu Ghraib news, U.S. Army Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, who was in charge of the notorious prison, has been suspended. Bush made no mention of perhaps the biggest news out of Iraq on Monday, the Pentagon's decision to remove the top U.S. officer in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, from his duty in Iraq. He'd come under criticism for his handling of the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal. Sanchez is expected to be brought back to the United States and replaced by the Army's second-ranking general, General George Casey. The Associated Press reports Bush chose to give the speech at the United States Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in order to reach out to Pennsylvania voters. Since losing Pennsylvania in the 2000 election, Bush has visited the state 28 times. According to the Associated Press, Bush has visited no swing state more often. The Center for American Progress notes the irony in Bush's appearance at the War College, which has released a string of reports condemning the president's handling of the Iraq issue and the war on terror. In January, one War College professor released a report that concluded, quote, the invasion of Iraq was a diversion from the more narrow focus on defeating al-Qaeda. Another report came out in March warning that in Iraq, the U.S. was, quote, ignoring the more critical strategic aim of creating a stable democratic nation. And last month, a third report warned that U.S.-Arab relations would suffer if the U.S. fails to articulate a clear exit strategy from Iraq. While Bush was speaking at the War College, independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader spoke at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He called for a complete withdrawal from U.S. military and corporate interests from Iraq by the end of the year. Nader also called on U.S. forces to be replaced by peacekeeping forces from the United Nations. In Najaf, parts of the most sacred Shiite site in Iraq, the Imam Ali Shrine was damaged today in fighting between U.S. and backers of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The inner gate of the shrine, which leads to the tomb of Imam Ali, appears to have been hit by a projectile. Imam Ali was the Prophet Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, and he is the most revered saint among Shiite Muslims. Al Jazeera is broadcasting images of a torn veil covering the door to the inner shrine and damage on the walls nearby. Several people were injured in the mosque compound as well. Outside, hundreds of Shiite Iraqis protested the destruction. In Kentucky, a former member of a military police company assigned to Guantanamo Bay has come forward to tell the press how he was almost killed by his fellow American troops during a training exercise where his colleagues thought he was an actual inmate at Guantanamo. Sean Baker's story took place in 2003. He was stationed at the Cuban base where the military is holding hundreds of detainees captured in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Baker was ordered to play the role of a detainee in a training exercise. He says four U.S. soldiers who thought he was a detainee grabbed his arms, legs, and twisted him. One soldier got on his back and then began to choke him while pressing his head against the steel floor. After 20 or 30 seconds, Baker couldn't breathe. He gave the code word, red, to stop the exercise. But the beating continued until one of the soldiers noticed Baker was wearing army boots, indicating he was not a detainee, but one of them. Baker suffered a traumatic brain injury that has left him with a seizure disorder. The military hasn't confirmed Baker's story, but a spokesperson for the Kentucky National Guard told the Associated Press, quote, there was a training accident after which he was medically discharged. In Portland, Oregon, the FBI has admitted it mistakenly detained a Muslim lawyer in connection to the Madrid bombings that killed 191 people in March. Brandon Mayfield was picked up as a material witness in the case after the FBI claimed it had matched his fingerprints to prints found near the scene of the attacks. Now the FBI says the fingerprints don't match. Mayfield, who's a convert to Islam and a former U.S. Army lieutenant, said after his release, quote, this is a serious infringement on our civil liberties. In a climate of fear, this war on terrorism has gone to the extreme, and innocent people are the victims as a result, unquote. Mayfield was held for nearly 3 weeks, although no charges were ever filed against him. In Georgia, the former civil rights leader H.R.A.P. Brown, who's now known as Jamil Abdullah Alamin, lost his bid Monday for the Georgia Supreme Court to overturn his conviction for the shooting of a sheriff's deputy 4 years ago. And the National Trust for Historic Preservation has put the state of Vermont on its list of endangered places in the country because the state is in danger of losing its small-town charm by the growth of Walmart. It marks the first time the National Trust has put a state on its annual list. Vermont has four Walmart stores and at least one more on the way.
سلام على دار السلام. السلام جزيل وعتبى على أن العتاب طويل أبغداد لا أهوى سواك مدينة
Amer Tawfiq from the soundtrack of the movie about Baghdad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a primetime address at the Army War College in Pennsylvania last night, President Bush outlined his vision for the future of Iraq. The speech came just 5 weeks before the so-called June 30th handover and 5 months before the U.S. elections. It kicked off a White House campaign to shore up public support, will be followed by a speech every week until the June 30th transition. Bush's approval rating has hit an all-time low, 41% last week. The main body of Bush's address focused on a strategy for the transfer of sovereignty in Iraq.
There are 5 steps in our plan to help Iraq achieve democracy and freedom. We will hand over authority to a sovereign Iraqi government, help establish security, continue rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure, encourage more international support, and move toward a national election that will bring forward new leaders empowered by the Iraqi people. The first of these steps will occur next month when our coalition will transfer full sovereignty to a government of Iraqi citizens who will prepare the way for national elections. On June 30th, the coalition provisional authority will cease to exist and will not be replaced. The occupation will end, and Iraqis will govern their own affairs. America's ambassador to Iraq, John Negroponte, will present his credentials to the new president of Iraq. Our embassy in Baghdad will have the same purpose as any other American embassy, to assure good relations with a sovereign nation. America and other countries will continue to provide technical experts to help Iraq's ministries of government. But these ministries will report to Iraq's new prime minister. The United Nations Special Envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, is now consulting with a broad spectrum of Iraqis to determine the composition of this interim government. The Special Envoy intends to put forward the names of interim government officials this week. In addition to a president, 2 vice presidents, and a prime minister, 26 Iraqi ministers will oversee government departments from health to justice to defense. This new government will be advised by a national council, which will be chosen in July by Iraqis representing their country's diversity. This interim government will exercise full sovereignty until national elections are held. America fully supports Mr. Brahimi's efforts, and I have instructed the coalition provisional authority to assist him in every way possible.
President Bush speaking last night at the Army War College in Pennsylvania. Although Bush didn't announce any significant policy changes, he did promise to demolish the Abu Ghraib prison, the site of the now notorious photos of physical and sexual torture committed by U.S. soldiers against Iraqi detainees.
I send American troops to Iraq to defend our security, not to stay as an occupying power. I send American troops to Iraq to make its people free, not to make them American. Iraqis will write their own history and find their own way. As they do, Iraqis can be certain. A free Iraq will always have a friend in the United States of America.
That was President Bush speaking last night in a major primetime address. His speech carried live in many parts of the Arabic-speaking world, including on Al Jazeera. In a moment, we're going to speak with one of the editors at Al Jazeera. But we go back to President Bush's address last night.
A new Iraq will also need a humane, well-supervised prison system. Under the dictator, prisons like Abu Ghraib were symbols of death and torture. That same prison became a symbol of disgraceful conduct by a few American troops who dishonored our country and disregarded our values. America will fund the construction of a modern maximum security prison. When that prison is completed, detainees at Abu Ghraib will be relocated. Then, with the approval of the Iraqi government, we will demolish the Abu Ghraib prison as a fitting symbol of Iraq's new beginning.
President Bush speaking last night in Pennsylvania. Today, we're joined by two people to respond to the president's address. Sinan Antoun is an Iraqi poet, novelist, and translator. Studied English at Baghdad University before coming to the United States after the Gulf War in 1991. Only recently returned to make a film there. We are also joined by one of the editors of Al Jazeera. There's a new film just out on Al Jazeera in which he is one of the people featured. His name is Samir Khader, who is senior producer there, Arab language satellite TV news channel at Al Jazeera based in Qatar. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having us.
Well, let us begin with, Samir, your response to the president's address last night.
Well, frankly, it seemed that there hasn't been nothing new in this speech. He laid out more clearly what the United States wanted to do with Iraq, except for one single thing that really surprised me when he said that by the 30th of June, occupation will end and the CPA will no longer exist, but American troops will remain there. So if the American army will remain in Iraq, what do you call the situation? What is an occupation? An occupation in the presence of a foreign army?
Well, let's put that question to Sinan Antoun.
Well, this is obviously fodder, you know, primetime fodder for the campaign. Everything that Bush says and does from now and recently is all just about the re-election campaign. It has nothing to do with the Iraqis, as you said. It's broadcast 4 a.m. in the Arab world. Who's going to be listening to it? But also this whole sovereignty in June 30th, I mean, it's just really a distraction. It's actually handing over sovereignty to Negroponte. That's what I call it. And also, let's remember that Colin Powell said a number of times that we'll give the Iraqis enough sovereignty so that they ask us to stay. But more importantly, there is a number of outright lies in Bush's speech about that the CPA will cease to exist. As we speak now, already Bremer had formed a number of committees dealing with each ministry that actually have the control over the ministry's affairs in Iraq. So it doesn't matter who is going to be in those governments, and it's really disastrous that here we're going to hand sovereignty over and we don't even have one or two names. They don't even know who they're going to hand sovereignty to. So the whole thing is a big chaos on the ground, but of course it's going to be repeated time and again in the next few months to try to salvage Bush's re-election.
Samir, how does Al Jazeera talk about this handover of partial sovereignty, if you will?
We can't take position, of course. We report politics, but we don't do politics on our Jazeera antenna. But generally speaking, we hope for the best for the Iraqi people, but we're not very optimistic. We know that there will be a transfer of sovereignty, but what does this mean exactly, transfer of sovereignty? You have just heard Bush last night saying that in every ministry there will be technical expertise, technical American experts. I tend to see that these technical experts will play the role of commissars that used to be played by Soviet Communist Party within the whole ministries and the army. So who will be holding the power, the minister or this technical expert? We have to wait and see.
Do you even use the term sovereignty?
Yes, when it's pronounced by the American president, we use it, but we don't think that up till now there is one single Arab state who has complete sovereignty.
We're going to break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about two films today. One, Control Room, about Al Jazeera, and we'll be joined by the filmmaker as well. And then we're going to talk about an unusual film that has just been made called About Baghdad, that brings you the voices of Iraqis of all walk of life, responding both to Saddam Hussein and to President Bush. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Taufik, Jahina, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 220 radio stations and public access TV stations around the country, now our first PBS station, and on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network. Today we're going to talk about a news network in this country that is actually not based in this country. Their offices were bombed twice in Afghanistan. Their Baghdad correspondent was killed in Iraq. Their reporter was arrested at a summit, going to a summit in Crawford, Texas. Their New York correspondents thrown off the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. We're talking about Al Jazeera, the Arabic satellite television station that is based in Qatar. Al Jazeera's programming has been seen as controversial by some in Washington ever since it began broadcasting 7 years ago. The network has since grown into a CNN of the Arab world, reaching up to 55 million viewers. Now there's a new documentary out about Al Jazeera. It's called Control Room, and it looks at Al Jazeera during the time of the invasion of Iraq. The filmmaker is Jahan Nujaim, who she is co-director of other films, Startup.com, which chronicles the rise and fall of internet startups. This, her film, Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Why did you decide to focus on Al Jazeera?
Well, you just gave the list of everything that's happened to Al Jazeera, how they've been criticized by the U.S. government, how they've been, well, during the war, their reporters were kicked out of the stock exchange. But the list goes on in terms of the amount of people on both sides, the Arab governments that have criticized them and kicked them out of many Arab countries. And then following The American government was very critical of Al Jazeera. Yet we've never been able to see inside them. We've never been able to see who are the people that run this channel, what motivates them, what are they showing, how are they seeing the Iraq war. And I was very curious to get inside the station that nobody in the States had really seen before.
At the same time you're in the station, you're constantly showing what's going on from CENTCOM, from Central Command, and that's a key place setter throughout the film. Let's hear what Donald Rumsfeld has to say about Al Jazeera from the film Control Room.
Al Jazeera has a pattern of playing propaganda over and over and over again. What they do is when there's a bomb goes down, they grab some children and some women and pretend that the bomb hit the women and the children. And it seems to me that it's up to all of us to try to tell the truth, to say what we know, to say what we don't know, and recognize that we're dealing with people that are perfectly willing to lie to the world to attempt to further their case. And to the extent people lie, ultimately they are caught lying and they lose their credibility. And one would think it wouldn't take very long for that to happen dealing with people like this.
People like this. Samir Khader, senior producer with Al Jazeera, your response to the defense secretary.
If Mr. Rumsfeld say that we're having a pattern of lies and repeating it over and over and over again. I have this feeling that he's telling the world that we, Al Jazeera, are able every day to fool more than 50 million of our audience, 50 million Arabs and Arab-speaking people around the world. This, I don't know how can this be done, but one thing that I can say is Mr. Rumsfeld is no journalist. He doesn't know what objectivity is, and if he wants to criticize, he should use what we call constructive criticism.
Let's talk about the history of Al Jazeera. Why was it founded? What is its connection to Qatar?
Al Jazeera was founded in 1996. It started broadcasting on November 1st, 1996. And the objective of this channel was, from the beginning, is to bring something new to the Arab world. The Arabs were used to listen or to discover what happens around them in their countries by listening to the outside, the BBC or Radio Monte Carlo broadcasting in Arabic, and sometimes to the Voice of America in Arabic. For the first time, Al Jazeera came to say to the Arab audience, look, you no longer need to listen to the outside to know what's happening in your countries. We are here. We will bring you credible, professional information with no red lines, no taboos. We will uncover corruption. We will talk about your daily life. Without managing anybody. If you like this, go ahead and join us. And I think that millions and millions have joined us.
I want to go to one of the more horrifying scenes in Control Room that all of us remember well from a year ago, and that was the killing of the Al Jazeera journalist Tariq Ayoob. Let's go to Control Room.
At 6:21, I received a phone call from our correspondent in Baghdad saying that there's a big fight around our office in Baghdad. So I put them on air live. And we heard everything, all the fighting going on, but none of our correspondents was able to go on top of the roof so as to be with us live, because they were said it was too dangerous. But they said if we can sneak out, we can try to manage it. At 6:47, the camera that was filming got stuck with the picture of Tariq Ayoob on the roof.
شيل الكاميرا شيل الكاميرا شيلها عن طارق طلعها على الجو طلع الكاميرا على الجو على على المكان التقليدي على
I shouted at them, telling them to move the camera out of the face of this guy because he has nothing to do with the event, the fighting. And they moved the camera. 10 minutes later, I was on the phone with the other correspondent, and he said, there's a plane turning over us, and now it's coming towards us, and it's, he said, picking down, nose down, which means formation of attack. And the American plane came and launched the missiles against our office, and the explosion killed Tarek Ayoub. When you announce that one of your staff was hurt, you expect phone calls from the families of all these reporters and cameramen. We received only one phone call from the wife of Tarek Ayoub, saying, what happened to Tarek? We told her, he didn't say it's Tarek. She said, I know, my heart tells me it's Tarek, and something happened to him. What can you say, tell her?
And that is Samir Khader, the senior producer with Al Jazeera, speaking in the film Control Room about the death of Tarek Ayoub, the Jordanian-Palestinian reporter who had just gotten to Baghdad. Is that right?
A week earlier. Yeah.
As he is sitting there on the roof behind some sandbags, you tell the cameraman who is up there with him, and I want to ask what happened to him, to pull away. Don't show him. Talk
yes.
about that.
Don't show him because the camera was supposed to show us what was going around our office. American troops were present there. American tanks were there. Iraqi soldiers were shooting at the Americans from the presidential palace, which was used to be behind our office. And the shooting was so intense that nobody, none of our reporters dared go to, up to the roof so as to report what's happening. So we used to take live only audio gunfire. And when Tarek managed to sneak out to the roof, the camera fell down. So instead of taking the scene of what's happening around the office, it took only Tarek. So I was shouting at the other reporter in Baghdad, please get this camera out of the face of this guy because it's not him, the event is elsewhere. And I don't know if it was something, because this was really the last time that we have seen Tarek alive.
Did you know him personally?
I've never met him personally, no.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to the cameraman?
You know, when the missile was launched against the office, it exploded and the office was destroyed. At that time, there were 23 staff members of Al Jazeera present in the office, and they just ran away. The cameraman was hurt, injured, but...
he was up on the roof with Tarek.
Yes, up on the top of the roof, yes. But when the... according to the people who were there, they said, we saw this plane coming down to us. So we started running. And the last one to be on in this queue was Tarek. He was unable to get to the door and come down.
Now, you had given Al Jazeera's coordinates to the Pentagon?
Yes. Not only Al Jazeera office in Baghdad, because we were the only channel present in several Arab cities broadcasting live from Baghdad in the center, Mosul and Erbil in the north, and Basra in the south. And we've given all the coordinates to the Pentagon, and we received an acknowledgement.
Hmm. What about what happened at the Sheraton?
The Sheraton.
Well, the hotel where only Al Jazeera...
The Palestine Hotel.
No, I mean at the in the city where only Al Jazeera was there.
Yes. Jihan could tell you. Maybe.
This happened about a week earlier, before the bombing, actually. And we I was sitting in a general manager's meeting, and nobody was killed, so it wasn't taken, obviously, as seriously. But the journalists said, you know, this is a dangerous place to be right now. We want to be moving because we need to move our locations. And the management meeting said at that point in time, well, we need to give the new locations to the Pentagon. So they were being very sure to, as their journalists moved from place to place, to give the new coordinates.
So you have the killing of Tariq Ayub. You have the bombing of your offices in Kabul twice. Is that right, in Afghanistan?
Yes.
What is your dialogue with the Pentagon? I mean, in Kabul, your offices were bombed twice.
Let's say the following. In both cases, we contacted, of course, the American authorities and the Pentagon to see if there's an investigation, and we asked for an investigation. In both cases, to my knowledge, they have not been investigated. Even the death of Tariq Ayub has not been investigated. So I don't understand. At least when there's something happening, the Pentagon is ready to open an investigation. But in both cases, in Kabul and in Baghdad, they didn't do it. Why? You have to ask them.
Do you think it's a mistake to give the coordinates of the offices to the Pentagon?
No, absolutely not. Because really we were scared, because after our office in Kabul was targeted, and deliberately, as we think, we thought that the Americans could at any time target our office and pretend that they didn't know. So we gave them the coordinates. So giving them the coordinates or not giving the coordinates, they will know.
Do you feel you have support from your colleagues, from other journalists around the world?
Yes, yes. We have tremendous, really huge movement of support with Al Jazeera. That's, we are very thankful to all journalists around the world.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go to another clip of Control Room. Jahan Nujaim, can you set this clip up having to do with Central Command and the other key figure that you have throughout this film is a spokesperson for Central Command?
Lieutenant Rushing intrigued me because he was somebody that seemed very open to trying to understand the other side and to engage with the other side. And so he didn't have to have long conversations with Hassan Ibrahim, the other Jazeera reporter, yet they talked for hours on end. And I think I think that it was difficult for him because it wasn't something that, even though it was his assignment to be dealing with the Arab reporters, it wasn't always easy. He was often seen as kind of going over to the other side in a way, I think, by the other people working with him.
This is U.S. Central Command's Josh Rushing talking about the images of POWs and civilians shown on Al Jazeera.
The night they showed the POWs and the dead soldiers, Al Jazeera showed them. It was powerful because America doesn't show those kind of images. Most of the news in America won't show really gory images. And this showed American soldiers in uniform strewn about a floor, a coal tile floor. And it was revolting. It was absolutely revolting. It made me sick at my stomach. And then what hit me was the night before, there had been some kind of bombing in Basra. And Al Jazeera had shown images of the people. And they were equally, if not more horrifying, the images were. And I remember having seen it in the Al Jazeera office and thought to myself, wow, that's gross. That's bad. And then going away and probably eating dinner or something, and, you know, it didn't affect me as much. So the impact that had on me realizing that I just saw people on the other side, and those people in the Al Jazeera office must have felt the way I was feeling that night, and it upset me on a profound level that I wasn't as bothered as much the night before. It makes me hate war, but it doesn't make me believe that we're in a world that can live without war yet.
Samir Khader.
Yes. I'm really amazed. It makes me hate war. Coming from the mouth of an American Marine and the Central Command, this, for me, means only one thing, that behind all the abstraction of war, of Al Jazeera, of American military, they are human beings. They are human faces. And these human beings could develop, could interact with the other, could have a dialogue, which gives me the feeling that maybe I'm optimistic, but all the problems of the world could be solved through dialogue and discussion.
I want to ask, Jahan, what you were most surprised by as you filmed Al Jazeera. How long did you film?
I filmed for about 6 weeks, which isn't very long. The last film I made, I spent a year and a half filming. So when I left, I definitely felt like there's a possibility that there isn't a film here. And it took going through 200 hours of footage to realize we had something. In terms of surprise, I was surprised at the level of kind of experience and openness of Al Jazeera reporters. The two people, I mean, I'm definitely biased towards the two people that I followed because I tend to follow people that I like and that I'm inspired by. So I'm sure that there are other Jazeera reporters that I may not have liked so much. But the two people that I followed, Hassan and Samir, were people that have been in journalism for 25 years. Hassan has covered 10 wars, went to college at University of Arizona, grew up in Saudi Arabia, was in grade school with Osama bin Laden. Like, he's had a very, has visited the palaces of Saddam Hussein. I wanted to be around people with that level of experience to try and understand what was going on. Samir, again, has had a huge amount of experience in journalism and has covered a number of wars. And I think that the interesting thing is that it's not like just going down the street to get a job. In the Arab world, the access you have to being able to work at a network that is not run by the state it's very difficult because there aren't a lot of kind of free stations available to you. So I think that people who have a real dedication to working for the freedom of speech in the Arab world will go to Al Jazeera. So you do end up finding kind of a high level when you go there. And that was surprising to me after hearing all of the criticism in the Arab world and in the United States about Jazeera.
Samir, let's talk about the images of POWs and of casualties. In this country, in the U.S. networks, we hardly saw images of casualties, reporters calling them tasteless. In the rest of the world, they were everywhere. Can you talk about Al Jazeera's decisions, both around casualties and then also of showing POWs?
Look, we are in the business of news, and news means facts, and facts should prevail on speculation. Right from the beginning, the Americans announced and told the American people that this will be a very proper and clean surgical war, very quick. And there are no or very few casualties among civilians, and they suffered no losses. So when we had these pictures of soldiers killed or taking prisoners, we thought, okay, the Americans are saying and telling their people something, but these pictures show something else. If the Americans don't want to show these pictures, it's their decision. But our audience want to see these pictures, at least to see that the war is not as clean as the Americans used to pretend. So we showed them. But I think that the American audience or the American public opinion was fooled by the American media at that time by only talking about the heroic American soldiers, the patriotic war against terrorism, against weapons of mass destructions that used to threaten America, and to talk about the number of tanks and how progress they used to progress towards Baghdad, and showing pictures of satellite pictures of bombs exploding, and without telling the American people that what was the result of this explosion. So we decided in Al Jazeera to cover the same story as the American media, but from another perspective. It's the perspective of the human cost. Any war has a human cost, whether It's a human cost regarding the Iraqi population, the casualties among the Iraqi populations, or the human cost among the American soldiers.
I like what Lieutenant Rushing actually has said about this, which is that, you know, these pictures are disgusting, they make me queasy, they give me a stomachache, but war should give you a stomachache, and people should be seeing this, and Americans and Arabs should be seeing the casualties on both sides of the war, the Americans that are dying and the Iraqis that are dying, because it's not a clean war. So I guess that's what was also interesting about being at Jazeera, because we went through a lot of the footage of their library, and they used about 10% of the footage that they had. You know, there was a lot more gruesome footage in there, let's say. And so to see the very, very strong reaction from the American administration based on the 5% of the footage that they showed was very surprising to me. Because you see it in the States, it's very clean. It's very, you don't see any of this stuff.
Haven't the power of the pictures been proven by the photos that have gotten out now of the torture at Abu Ghraib? I think it's interesting to see the response in this country. There's often mentioned the Arab world is incensed. I don't think it's because Arabs have a particularly hypersensitive gene. I think the whole world is incensed when they see the pictures. You can hear, and that's one thing, but then the government can always say it's not true. But to see these pictures, I think it has really shown us the power of what an image
It makes has. It into reality. I mean, when you just see it in print somehow, it's not a reality. Like, you know, a week before those prison photos, or 2 weeks before the prison photos were released, 600 civilians were killed in Fallujah, and we didn't see the pictures. I read it on the subway, in one of the newspapers, and I was like, you know, oh my goodness. And then Samir sent footage back of Fallujah, and it really hit me how terrible it was. But it didn't hit the United States because you didn't see it.
Don't you share your footage with other networks? Doesn't CNN, for example, use your footage of bombs over Baghdad, especially when they were kicked out and they couldn't show it themselves?
Yeah. No, our footage is available to any station willing to take them. And many, 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 many American stations took these pictures. As to what did they do with these pictures, I don't know.
General Powell, Secretary of State Colin Powell, just went to Qatar. And word was he was putting pressure on the government there around Al Jazeera. Is that true?
I don't know. I didn't have the feeling that we were under pressure. I didn't receive any phone call from any high manager. Maybe there are discussions with the Qatari government, but the fact is that when Al Jazeera was created in 1996, the stated goal was the Qatari government will finance this station but will never, never, never interfere in the editorial line. And up till now, it was the case. And I hope it will continue to be the case.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. I know you're showing this film in many different places. I was just up in Vermont. We're celebrating independent media throughout the state in Brattleboro and Montpelier and Burlington. And they said that on June 1st at the Eclipse Theater in Stowe, Vermont, they're going to be showing Control Room, and you'll both be there. Are you traveling around the country?
We are, and actually you can check out where it's being released and when at controlroommovie.com. That's my little plug for people to check out where it's playing.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Samir Khader, senior producer with Al Jazeera, and Jahan Nujaim, the filmmaker who did this film over a six-week period around the invasion of Iraq. Al Jazeera means what, the word?
It means the island or the peninsula. But in both cases means the isolated place. We isolate ourselves from the environment of dictatorship and oppression, and we want to expand and to spread democracy, freedom, and free speech and human rights.
This is Democracy Now. When we come back, another film about Baghdad, Arab Voices. Stay with us.
مالي شغل بالسوق مريت اشوفك مالي شغل بالسوق مريت اشوفك
عطشان حفنا سنين واروى على شوفك عطشان حفنا سنين واروى على شوفك مالي شغل بالسوق مريت اشوفك مالي شغل بالسوق مريت اشوفك عطشان حفنا سنين واروى على شوفك عطشان حفنا سنين واروى على شوفك عطشان حفنا سنين واروى على شوفك اريد اتبع الدلال بيوصلك وراوي اريد اتبع الدلال واصلك وراوي وبعين خلي يشوف هجره شعيم البيت وبعين خلي يشوف هجره شعيم البيت مالي شغل بالسوق مر
السوق باي Amir Taufik from the soundtrack of About Baghdad. Earlier in the program, we heard from Sinan Antoun, an Iraqi writer and poet exiled under Saddam Hussein. Since then, he's lived and worked in the United States. He currently teaches Arabic and Arab literature at Dartmouth College. Last summer, as the invasion of Iraq was still in its early stages, Sinan Antoun returned to Baghdad with a group of activists and filmmakers. They walked around Baghdad with their cameras, talked to people from all walks of life and with many different opinions on the occupation. The result of their trip, a new film that's set to be released in a few weeks. It's called About Baghdad, produced by Encounter Productions. Sinan Antoun joins us in the studio along with another of the filmmaking team, Adam Shapiro. And we welcome you as well, Adam, and welcome back, Sinan. I thought we'd start with a clip of the film. And I was wondering, Sinan, if you could set this up for us. First, talk about the trip and you're spending the month in Baghdad and who you talk to and then set this up.
Well, we spent 3 weeks. We wanted to spend more time, of course, but because we're independent and we have limited resources, we couldn't spend any more time. But those 3 weeks from literally 7 o'clock in the morning to 7 at night before the curfew, we just spent basically going around Baghdad and interviewing, as you said, Iraqis of all walks of life and basically asking them how they felt about the legacy of living under Saddam's dictatorship and going through three wars, sanctions, and how they feel about the U.S. And the results that we got, which we kind of expected, is to show just the complexity that goes beyond the Manichaean view that Bush wants us to believe about Iraqis either being Saddam lovers or U.S. lovers. And what we got from most, if not all, Iraqis, that, you know, their worldview is much more complicated than that and as complicated as any other human being. The scene I believe we're going to see is one of the spontaneous. We also, although we had planned and organized forays into certain places in Baghdad where we thought it would encapsulate the whole complex relationship, but we also went around the streets and just had spontaneous interactions with people. And one of them, I believe, a man on the street, and he just said, you know, he came to the camera and said, you know, this in his view summarizes everything, how that, you know, what he believes the whole relationship and the complexity of what has happened, that Saddam, you know, having gone, that the student has gone, but now the master is here, and that summarizes everything for him.
Say it again, the student?
The student has gone, basically, and the master is here. He said that summarizes everything, and the people are the victim. And he said, right, you know, put that down as the summary of everything that has happened. And to me, I mean, we're always haunted by this, because really, if you want, not that there should be always a sentence that summarizes everything, but that does still, until today, summarize everything for Iraqis, especially after the recent revelations with Abu Ghraib and whatnot, basically, that the Iraqis have changed hands.
The student is here, the student has gone, and the master is here. We're going to listen to this without translation over it, and the film is in Arabic with subtitles. This is a scene from the street of Baghdad.
Allah التلميذ اجى الاستاذ هذا الحكي راح التلميذ اجى الاستاذ هذا ملخص ما مفيد الشعب هو الضحيه
صوتنا ما حد سمعه المسموع هو صوت الناس اللي تصيح وتصرخ وتعبت وصوت الناس اللي في المجتمع ما حد سمعه
That a scene from around Baghdad. And Adam Shapiro, the last person we heard from, the man speaking very softly, said, you have to hear voices from the core of society.
Exactly. This was one of the people who worked at Sinan's high school, where we went to visit and to show what had happened to his school and to meet some of the people from his past. And he made this point that the only voices that are coming out of Iraq these days that we're hearing are those who are screaming, those who are yelling, and that the society, the core of the society, the people themselves, aren't having their voices heard, their concerns, their needs heard by the media and by, you know, people in this country, especially Americans.
What was it like for you to return, Sinan? Why'd you leave?
I left because I'd always wanted to leave to escape Saddam's huge prison. But to go back, although I'd, you know, kept abreast of the news and followed the country's descent, but I was still shocked because no matter how much you read and see even, I mean, I was in Egypt at the time and I was watching Al Jazeera and reading all kinds of newspapers, but it was very shocking to see the actual destruction, not just of the war, but to me, the most damaging, and that's what a lot of people in our film also say, is to the social fabric of Iraq, really the destruction of the structure of Iraqi society, which basically had gone on for a long time, started by Saddam as he was aided by the U.S., but the crucial factor is the 13 years of the sanctions, which really had, you know, driven Iraq to the edge. So that the war was the final blow, and to me, it was just really depressing to see how drained and destroyed Iraqis are. I mean, they're still resilient, at least when we were there and wanted to rebuild the country, but really people are really drained. And that's what the man says. I mean, the core of the society that was supposed to rebuild Iraq, the intelligentsia, the middle class, is completely destroyed.
Adam Shapiro, a comparison, please, between occupations of Iraq and in the occupied territories. You're most well known for having gone into the compound of Yasser Arafat when it was under siege in Ramallah, the Israeli military. Now we hear that the Israeli military has pulled out of Gaza. Can you talk about having spent time in both places?
I think it's hard to compare, although what we're seeing today in Iraq, unfortunately and really tragically, is very reminiscent and of the tactics of the occupying forces that we find among Israeli forces. Even the very notion that soldiers are taking pictures of what they're doing, we find Israeli soldiers doing that as well to Palestinians at checkpoints as they're occupying cities and whatnot. And the people, the reaction, of course, from the people that they resist, that they do not want this occupation, they do not feel in control of their lives, just their daily life of trying to get to work, trying to get to school, trying to just sort of raise a family. This, the impact of occupation on how people understand what they control in their own personal space, this is something that we don't really have a sense of until you're living under occupation.
And the Israeli military pulling out of Rafah in Gaza,
right.
You feel that they'll stay out?
I don't think so. I mean, I think even today, I think some Israeli generals have said this is just a pause in the operation, and the pause is probably to give the soldiers a chance to catch their breath and they'll go back in.
Adam Shapiro and Sinan Antun, I want to thank you for being with us. The film that is just coming out is called About Baghdad. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fodo Kadus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.